It was an astonishing pronouncement. It was the American assumption of the possibility of labor's achieving wealth, applied with a vengeance to landless slaves under caste conditions. The very strength of its logic was the weakness of its common sense. Yet Andrew Johnson was the President of the United States. He was the leader of the Republican Party, which had just won the war. He declared in the face of an astounding array of testimony to the contrary that the South was peaceful and loyal, and the slaves really free. Congress did not believe the president or agree with him, but some were not yet prepared to break with him. Six Republicans deserted their party and voted to uphold the veto. The result was that by a vote of 30-18, the attempt to override the president's veto failed. The rift made in the Republican Party was wide. On the one side stood abolition democracy and curious alliance with triumphant northern industry, both united in self-defense against Johnson and the South. This northern unity, Johnson and Seward intended to disrupt, and did so, in part, when the veto of the Freedmen's Bureau was sustained. Seward followed this by an appeal for the quick resumption of peace and industry, and Johnson made an appeal to labor unrest and Western radicals. But here again, there was no natural union, and this Seward knew. His defense, therefore, of Johnson's plan was intended to soothe both industry and abolition without stressing radicalism. Washington's birthday had been fixed upon by the president's friends for a grand demonstration. The New York alderman endorsed the president's conservative, liberal, enlightened, and Christian policy with 100 guns salute on February 21st and 100 on February 22nd. Johnson was declared greater than Old Hickory. He was the highest pinnacle of the Mount of Fame. His feet were planted on the Constitution of his country. He was a modern edition of Andrew Jackson bound in calf. Indeed, it was said by the radicals in reply to the Democratic fireworks that more powder was burned in honor of the veto by the Copperheads than they consumed during the 4 years of war. Seward said at Cooper Union, "This, I think, is the difference between the president, who is a man of nerve, in the executive chair at Washington, and the nervous men who are in the House of Representatives. Both have got the Union restored not with slavery, but without it. Not with secession, flagrant or latent, but without it. Not with compromise, but without it. Not with disloyal states or representatives, but with loyal states and representatives. Not with rebel debts, but without them. Not with exemption from our own debts for suppressing the rebellion, but with equal liabilities upon the rebels and the loyal men. Not with freedmen and refugees abandoned to suffering and persecution, but with freedmen employed in productive, self-sustaining industry, with refugees under the protection of law and order." The man of nerve sees that it has come out right at last, and he accepts the situation. He does not forget that in this troublesome world of ours, the most to be secured by anybody is to have things come out right. Nobody can ever expect to have them brought out altogether in his own way. The nervous men, on the other hand, hesitate, delay, debate, and agonize, not because it has come out right, but because they have not individually had their own way in bringing it to a happy termination. As to the Freedmen's Bureau bill, he said, "I have not given prominence in these remarks to the conflict of opinion between the President and Congress in reference to the Bureau for the Relief of Freedmen and Refugees. That conflict is, in its consequences, comparatively unimportant. It would excite little interest and produce little division if it stood alone. It is because it has become the occasion for revealing the difference that I have already described that it has attained the importance which seems to surround it." He proceeded to point out that the present Freedmen's Bureau bill had not expired and might not expire for another year, and that, therefore, during the next year, Congress might still prolong its existence. Ought the President of the United States to be denounced in the house of his friends for refusing in the absence of any necessity to occupy or retain and to exercise power greater than those which are exercised by any imperial magistrate in the world. Judge ye, I trust that this fault of declining imperial powers, too hastily tendered by a too confiding Congress, may be forgiven by a generous people. This was an adroit defense, but Johnson could not let well enough alone. He was deprived of his mentor, and assuming his vivid role of stump speaker, possibly with a few stimulants, he felt called upon this same Washington's birthday to reply to a committee which had waited upon him with resolutions. He was speaking after the 14th Amendment in its first form had been reported to the House of Representatives and sent back to the Committee of 15. With that, as well as the vetoed Freedmen's Bureau bill and the pending Civil Rights bill in mind, he recited again his services to the Union during the war. He reminded his auditors that when rebellion manifested itself in the South, he stood by the government. He was for the Union with slavery. He was for the Union without slavery. In either alternative, he was for the government and the Constitution. Then he went on with the classic argument. You have been struggling for 4 years to put down a rebellion. You contended at the beginning of that struggle that a state had not a right to go out. And when you determined by the executive, by the military, and by the public judgment that these states cannot have any right to go out, this committee turns around and assumes that they are out and that they shall not come in. I say that when the states that attempted to secede comply with the Constitution and give sufficient evidence of loyalty, I shall extend to them the right hand of fellowship, and let peace and union be restored. I am opposed to the Davises and Toombses, the Slidells, and the long list of such. But when I perceive, on the other hand, men still opposed to the Union, I am free to say to you that I am still with the people. Suppose I should name to you those whom I look upon as being opposed to the fundamental principles of this government, and now laboring to destroy them. I say Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania. I say Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. I say Wendell Phillips of Massachusetts. Finally, Johnson became melodramatic. Are they not satisfied with one martyr? Does not the blood of Lincoln appease the vengeance and wrath of the opponents of this government? Is their thirst still unslaked? Do they want more blood? Have they not honor and courage enough to effect the removal of the presidential obstacle otherwise than through the hands of the assassin? I am not afraid of assassins, etc., etc. Small wonder that the New York Tribune and the Philadelphia Press reported that Johnson was drunk when he made his speech. But the main cause of his drunkenness was not necessarily whiskey. It was constitutional inability to understand men and movements. This was not time to straddle on the slavery question. That question has been settled. The crucial question now was, what will the South do when it comes back to Congress? What will it do to Negroes? And even more important, in the minds of many, what will it do to the new industry? The latter question struck deepest, but the former voiced itself loudest. The masses of the loyal people must be as agreed to arise against this veto of a measure, intended as a bulwark against slavery and treason, as they were on the night when the flag of the Union was first hauled down from Fort Sumter, said the Chicago Tribune. Congress immediately hit back with a concurrent resolution not to admit Southern congressmen to either house until the status of the Southern states was settled. This had passed the House of Representatives after dilatory tactics February 20th, but was not considered in the Senate until February 23rd after Johnson's speech. It was passed after debate March 2nd, and thus Stevens' original resolution of December 4th was finally confirmed. Here evidently there was no small ground for compromise. Either Johnson must bow to the will of the majority of his party in Congress, or, led by him, the South would be in the saddle in 1866. Many who had criticized Sumner in December now were on his side. The President and the South, on the other hand, were greatly encouraged. Despite the majority which the Republicans had in Congress, they could not override a presidential veto. With the reaction that Johnson and the South expected to the next election, the Republicans would lose power, and the South, united with Northern and Western democracy, would rule. The Southerners resumed their drive to complete their black codes and their program of reducing the Negro to a servile caste. The president, drunk with his new feeling of power, showed his entire misapprehension of the nature of the forces working against him. Congress girded itself for battle, not mainly because the virtual re-enslavement of the Negro aroused them, but because this was the symptom of a reassertion of power on the part of the South, which might affect the debt, the tariff, and the national banking system. The president and his supporters were going to insist upon the full political power of the South, unhampered by a Freedmen's Bureau or by Negro civil rights. Had it not been for the presence of the Negro, this attitude of the South could not have arisen. Never before in modern history has a conquered people treated their conqueror with such consummate arrogance. The South hid behind the darkness of the colored men and thumbed their noses at the nation. For the Negro, Andrew Johnson did less than nothing when once he realized that the chief beneficiary of labor and economic reform in the South would be freedmen. His inability to picture Negroes as men made him oppose efforts to give them land, oppose national efforts to educate them, and above all things, oppose their rights to vote. He even went so far as to change plans which he had thought out and announced before he faced the Negro problem. He once said that representation ought to be based on voters, but no sooner did he learn that Thaddeus Stevens advocated the same thing than he became dumb on the subject and had no advice to offer. He had advocated the confiscation of the land of the rich Southerners and penalties on wealth gained through slavery. When he realized that Negroes would be beneficiaries of any such action, he said not another word. He was a thick and thin advocate of universal suffrage in the hands of the laborer and common man, until he realized that some people actually thought that Negroes were men. He opposed monopoly on the New Jersey railroads, until Charles Sumner joined him. The Civil Rights Bill, which was taken up next, made Negroes citizens of the United States, and punished any persons who deprived them of civil rights under any state law. They shall have the same right in every state and territory in the United States to make and enforce contracts, to sue, be parties and give evidence, to inherit, purchase, lease, sell, hold, and convey real and personal property, and to full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property as is enjoyed by the white citizens, and shall be subject to like punishment, pains and penalties, and to none other any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, to the contrary notwithstanding. It gave to the district courts of the United States jurisdiction in crimes and offenses against the Act, gave the power of arrest to United States marshals and district attorneys, and provided fines and penalties. David Bingham of Ohio brought up a difficulty. He reminded Congress that the first 8 amendments to the Constitution could not be enforced by the federal government, since they were held to be limitations upon the federal power, and that, therefore, the power to punish offenses against life, liberty, and property was one of the reserved powers of the state. He therefore suggested a constitutional amendment which would punish all violations of the Bill of Rights by state officers. He reminded the House that even when property had been taken by the states without the due process of the law, there was no remedy in the federal courts, and that this had been affirmed in a recent case in Maryland. His proposal went to the Committee of 15. The Civil Rights Bill passed the Senate, was amended in the House, and was agreed to by both houses March 14, 1866. The debate on the Civil Rights Bill and the Freedmen's Bureau Bill made it clear that the emancipation of the slaves meant increased representation in Congress and in the Electoral College whenever the Southern states were readmitted, and that this increase in power would take place whether the Negroes were enfranchised or not. Moreover, the Civil Rights Act might be repealed. The United States might be made to pay all or a part of the Confederate debt, and Congress might repudiate the debt. The debate, therefore, on the Civil Rights Bill made the necessity of a constitutional amendment clear. On March 27th, President Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Bill with curious logic. He feared that under this bill, Chinese, Indians, and Gypsies, as well as Negroes, might be made citizens. He declared that a citizen of the United States would not necessarily be a citizen of a state. He again questioned whether it was good policy to act on citizenship of Negroes, since 11 of the 36 states were unrepresented. 4 million of them have just emerged from slavery into freedom. Can it be reasonably supposed that they possess the requisite qualifications to entitle them to all the privileges and equalities of citizens of the United States? One wonders what Andrew Johnson expected the Negroes to be. They were not to be citizens, they were not to be voters, and yet he repeatedly assured them that they were free. He went on with another strange argument, declaring that the bill discriminated against large numbers of intelligent, worthy, and patriotic foreigners, and in favor of the Negro, to whom, after long years of bondage, the avenues of freedom and opportunity have just now been suddenly opened. Thus, he thought Negroes less familiar with the character of American institutions than foreigners. And yet foreigners must wait 5 years for naturalization and be of good moral character. He said that if Congress could give the equal civil rights enumerated to Negroes, it could also give them the right to vote and the right to hold office. He objected to state officers being liable to arrest for discriminating against Negroes. He objected to the interference of Congress with the judiciary and assuming jurisdiction of subjects which had always been treated by state courts. Again, he returned to his astonishing economics. The white race and the black race of the South have hitherto lived together under the relation of master and slave. Capital owning labor. Now, suddenly, that relation is changed, and as to ownership, capital and labor are divorced. They stand now each master of itself. In this new relation, one being necessary to the other, there will be a new adjustment, which both are deeply interested in making harmonious. Each has equal power in settling the terms, and if left to the laws that regulate capital and labor, it is confidently believed that they will satisfactorily work out the problem. Capital, it is true, has more intelligence. But labor is never so ignorant as not to understand its own interests, not to know its own value, and not to see that capital must pay that value. This bill frustrates this adjustment. It intervenes between capital and labor, and attempts to settle questions of political economy through the agency of numerous officials whose interest it will be to foment discord between the two races. For as the breach widens, their employment will continue, and when it is closed, their occupation will terminate. He declared that this law establishes, for the security of the colored race, safeguards which go infinitely beyond any that the general government have ever provided for the white race, and therefore discriminates against the white race. He declared the bill a step toward concentrating all legislative power in the national government. A perfect equality of the white and colored races is attempted to be fixed by federal law in every state of the Union, over the vast field of state jurisdiction covered by the enumerated rights. In no one of these can any state ever exercise any power of discrimination between the different races. He then fetched up his heavy artillery of social equality to stampede the prejudiced. In the exercise of state policy over matters exclusively affecting the people of each state, it has frequently been thought expedient to discriminate between the two races. By the statutes of some of the states, northern as well as southern, it is enacted, for instance, that white persons shall not intermarry with a Negro or a mulatto. While he did not believe that this particular bill would annul state laws in regard to marriage, Nevertheless, if Congress had the power to provide that there should be no discrimination in the matters enumerated in the bill, then it could pass a law repealing the laws of the states in regard to marriage. He continued, "Hitherto, every subject embraced in the enumeration of rights contained in this bill has been considered as exclusively belonging to the states. They all relate to the internal police and economy of the respective states. If it be granted that Congress can repeal all state laws discriminating between whites and blacks in the subjects covered by this bill, why, it may be asked, may not Congress repeal in the same way all state laws discriminating between the two races on the subject of suffrage and office?" Speaking of the general effect of the bill, he declared it interfered with the municipal legislation of the states, with the relations existing exclusively between a state and its citizens, or between inhabitants of the same state, an absorption and assumption of power by the general government, which, if acquiesced in, must sap and destroy our federative system of limited powers and break down the barriers which preserve the rights of the states. It is another step, or rather stride, toward centralization and the concentration of all legislative powers in the national government. The president's veto of the Civil Rights Bill offended the nation. Senator Stewart declared that the president had promised not to veto this bill, and for that reason the senator had voted to sustain the veto of the Freedmen's Bureau Bill. Senator Trumbull had publicly announced that the president would not veto the Civil Rights Bill. Henry Ward Beecher had urged him to sign it. Even in the president's cabinet, none of the members, except Seward and Wells, agreed with Johnson. Sumner wrote, "Nobody can yet see the end. Congress will not yield. The president is angry and brutal. Seward is the marplot." In the cabinet, on the question of the last veto, there were 4 against it to 3 for it. So even 3 among his immediate advisers, the president is left in a minority. Stanton reviewed at length the bill, section by section, in the cabinet, and pronounced it an excellent and safe bill every way from beginning to end. But the veto message was already prepared, and an hour later was sent to Congress. The time for the final test between Johnson and Congress had come. There ensued some sharp political maneuvering. Morgan, Wiley, and Stewart were won over to the majority, and Stockton, a Johnson man from New Jersey, was unseated on a technicality. Thus, on April 6th and 9th, Congress overrode the veto. The Civil Rights Bill became law, and Johnson faced a Congress able to work its will. There was one other matter, besides amending the Constitution, on which Congress might take significant action. According to the current American creed, full protection of a citizen could only be accomplished by possession of the right to vote. This was not wholly true, even in the North, and with the ballot in the hands of white men. Nevertheless, it still retained a great element of truth, for only with universal suffrage could the mass of workers begin that economic revolution which would eventually emancipate them. They would have to use their ballot at first in conjunction with the petty bourgeois, that is, in conjunction with the small property holder who was being hard-pressed by the new concentrated capital of industry, in conjunction with the small Western farmer who was pushed to the wall by the railway and land monopoly. But armed with the ballot, this preliminary fight against the power of capital would clear the way for the final fight, which would make democracy real among the workers. While the Committee of 15 was groping its way to action, there was a chance for Congress to express its real feeling on the ballot. There might be a question in the minds of constitutional hair splitters as to how far Congress could coerce states in defining the right of suffrage. But Congress ruled directly the District of Columbia. Congress had the right to decide as to the political franchise in territories. Would it not be the first step toward a logical and consistent end for Congress to establish Negro suffrage in the district and in all territories which were set up? Thus, among the first bills introduced in the 39th Congress were bills to give the Negro the right to vote in the District of Columbia, and this demand was supported by petitions and speeches, and especially well-written petitions from the educated Negroes of the district. In January 1866, there came a notable petition from the colored people signed by John F. Cook, a wealthy octoroon of a free Negro family, and 25 other citizens. It did not come from freedmen or laborers, but from property holders of Negro descent, many of whom had been born free. Kelly of Pennsylvania read it in part to the House. "We are intelligent enough to be industrious, to have accumulated property, to build and sustain churches and institutions of learning. We are and have been educating our children without the aid of any school fund, and until recently had for many years been furnishing, unjustly as we deem, a portion of the means for the education of the white children of the district. We are intelligent enough to be amenable to the same laws and punishable alike with others for the infraction of said laws. We sustain as fair a character on the records of crime and statistics of pauperism as any other class in the community, while unequal laws are continually barring our way in the effort to reach and possess ourselves of the blessings attendant upon a life of industry and self-denial and of virtuous citizenship. Experience likewise teaches that that debasement is most humane, which is most complete. The possession of only a partial liberty makes us more keenly sensible of the injustice of withholding those other rights which belong to a perfect manhood. Without the right of suffrage, we are without protection and liable to combinations of outrage. Petty officers of the law, respecting the source of power, will naturally defer to the one having a vote, and the partiality thus shown will work much to the disadvantage of the colored citizens. However, there were some special reasons for avoiding this ticklish subject. After all, Washington was the capital of the nation. It had long been a center of Southern society. To give the Negroes political freedom and partial control there was a long step and a decisive one. The people of the district hastily organized a counterstroke and presented to the Senate a communication from the mayor, in which he asserted that a special vote had been taken December 21st to ascertain the opinion of the people of Washington on the question of Negro suffrage. He meant, of course, the white people, and the vote was overwhelming, 6,591 against Negro suffrage and 35 for it. The communication proceeded in a fine climax of Southern rhetoric, to say that this unparalleled unanimity of sentiment, which pervades all classes of this community, in opposition to the extension of the right of suffrage to that class, engenders an earnest hope that Congress, in according to this expression of their wishes, the respect and consideration that would as individual members yield to those whom they immediately represent, would abstain from the exercise of its absolute power, and so avert an impending future apparently so objectionable to those over whom, by the fundamental law of the land, they have exclusive jurisdiction. A long argument ensued, which showed that Congress was not ready to declare itself on Negro suffrage. Further action was postponed for another year, and a bill for Negro suffrage in the District of Columbia did not pass Congress until December 1866. It became a law in January 1867. Meantime, the Committee of 15 had met first December 26, 1865. Charles Sumner was considered too radical on the Negro question to be a member of it, and so the committee was headed by a conservative, Fessenden of Maine, who wished to stand by President Johnson and was strongly, sometimes even bitterly, opposed to the radicalism of Sumner. Stevens, the great protagonist of curbing the political power of the South and completely emancipating the Negro, was the prime figure in the committee. Then there was Bingham of Ohio, the more or less conscious defender of property. Conkling of New York, the sophisticated, exquisite corporation lawyer, and Boatwell of Massachusetts. There were three Democrats, of whom the most distinguished was Johnson of Maryland, the strongest border state representative in Congress, handicapped by a legal mind, and the narrow-minded Rogers of New Jersey. A subcommittee of the Committee of 15 courteously waited on President Johnson, and he consented to do nothing more toward Reconstruction for the present in order to secure harmony of action. On December 26th, at the first meeting of the committee, Stevens brought forward his proposal to base representation on voters. And singularly enough, later in this same month, Johnson, in an interview with Senator Dixon of Connecticut, said that if, however, amendments are to be made to the Constitution, changing the basis of representation and taxation, and he did not deem them at all necessary to the present time, he knew of none better than a simple proposition embraced in a few lines, making in each state the number of qualified voters the basis of representation, and the value of property the basis of direct taxation. Such a proposition could be embraced in the following terms. Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the number of qualified voters in each state. Such amendment, the president also suggested, would remove from Congress all issues in reference to the political equality of the races. It would lead the states to determine absolutely the qualifications of their own voters with regard to color. And thus, the number of representatives to which they would be entitled in Congress would depend upon the number upon whom they conferred the right of suffrage. The president in this connection expressed the opinion that the agitation of the Negro franchise question in the District of Columbia at this time was a mere entering wedge to the agitation of the question throughout the states, and was ill-timed, uncalled for, and calculated to do great harm. He believed that it would engender enmity, contention, and strife between the two races, and lead to a war between them, which would result in great injury to both and the certain extermination of the Negro population. Precedence, he thought, should be given to more important and urgent matters, legislation upon which was essential to the restoration of the Union, the peace of the country, and the prosperity of the people. Here, surely, was logic and understanding in plain sight. But not only did the president eventually drop this proposal, but even in committee, opposition appeared. Boatwell suggested at the third meeting of the committee, January 9th, that he preferred to retain population as the basis of apportionment, with the provision that no state should make any distinctions in the exercise of the elective franchise on account of race or color. Boatwell was from Massachusetts, and New England, through Blaine, had protested vigorously against the Stevens proposition in the House the day before, January 8th. It was a curious situation which Blaine explained in part, and in part he did not. New England had lost a good proportion of its male population by migration to the West, and it did not allow women to vote. New England, moreover, had a large immigrant population which she was using in her mills, and on which a part of her representation in Congress was based. She proposed to make this population still larger. She proposed also to reduce the voting power of this laboring population not only by confining the vote to the native-born and naturalized, but also by a literacy qualification. Through Blaine, therefore, spoke the exploiting manufacturer, and voiced an idea as different from Sumner's as one could well imagine. To base population on voters was, in the eyes of industry, to keep down the representation of the South, to be sure, but also to transfer the balance of political power from the East to the West, and in the West, industry was not so sure of its dictatorship. Consequently, the Committee of 15 was compelled to take steps in another direction. On January 12th, Bingham introduced a proposal to the committee for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing civil rights. It said, "The Congress shall have the power to make all laws necessary and proper to secure to all persons in every state within this Union equal protection in their rights of life, liberty, and property." This proposition, destined to become part of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, had been introduced early in December in the House of Representatives. The Committee of 15 referred the Bingham proposal to a subcommittee consisting wholly of Republicans. At the same time, the committee insisted that the basis of representation provided for in the Constitution should be changed. Johnson of Maryland adhered to the Stevens proposal of making voters the basis. New England and New York objected, and this matter was left to the consideration of the same subcommittee. Meantime, three other propositions were submitted. 1. Representation should be based on population, but if colored people were disfranchised, they should not be counted in the apportionment. Moral. 2. Representatives should be apportioned according to population, except that Negroes, Indians, Chinese, and other colored persons, if they were not allowed to vote, should not be counted in the apportionment. Williams. 3. Representatives were to be apportioned among the states according to the whole number of citizens of the United States, provided that whenever in any state, civil or political rights or privileges should be denied or abridged on account of race or color, all persons of such race or color should be excluded from the basis of representation or taxation. Conkling. On January 16th, a proposed 14th Amendment was considered in two parts. The first part had alternative propositions. A. Apportioning representation according to the number of citizens and making inoperative and void any laws whereby any distinction is made in political or civil rights or privileges on account of race, creed, or color. B. The alternative proposition was the Conkling proposal. The second part of the amendment was Bingham's proposal that Congress shall have power to make all laws necessary and proper to secure to all citizens of the United States the same equal protection in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property. These propositions went to subcommittees and were reported back January 20th. The Civil Rights section of Bingham appeared in the strongest and most specific form which it ever took. Congress shall have power to make all laws necessary and proper to secure to all citizens of the United States in every state the same political rights and privileges, and to all persons in every state equal protection in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property. It was voted 10-4 to consider this proposition of Bingham's separately, and by a vote of 11-3, the second resolution on apportionment was chosen as a proposed 14th Amendment. This excluded from representation Negroes who were denied the right to vote. Stevens wished to amend this by declaring who were citizens. Conkling, however, moved to strike out the phrase citizens of the United States and insert persons in every state, excluding Indians not taxed. This was a move to ensure the counting of the foreign-born as a part of the basis of apportionment and was in accordance with the New England idea. Stevens, Fessenden, and Bingham were against it, but it passed 11-3. On January 22nd, this section on apportionment was reported to Congress as a 14th Amendment and was the first effort of the Committee of 15 to prepare for Reconstruction by constitutional amendment. This was before the Freedmen's Bureau Bill or the Civil Rights Bill had passed Congress, and the bill for suffrage in the District of Columbia, while it had passed the House, had not been considered in the Senate and was not destined to be for several months. This fact is a sufficient answer to the accusation that the Committee of 15 purposely delayed action on the problems of Reconstruction. Within less than a month after it began work, it laid its first proposition before Congress. Stevens reported this first form of the 14th Amendment to the House and asked rather peremptorily that it pass before sundown. His reason was that there were numbers of state legislatures in session and that they could consider it immediately. But he was disappointed. There was too much opposition in his own group. Conkling elaborated and made specific the argument which Stevens had first brought forward. The 4 million people who had suddenly been released from slavery, while falling within the category of free persons, were not yet political persons. This emancipated multitude has no political status. Emancipation vitalizes only natural rights, not political rights. Enfranchisement alone carries with it political rights, and these emancipated millions are no more enfranchised now than when they were slaves. They never had political power. Their masters had a fraction of power as masters. But since the relationship of master and slave was destroyed, this fraction of power could no longer survive in the master's. There was only one place where it could logically go, and that was to the Negroes. But since it was said that they are unfit to have it, it is a power astray without a rightful owner. It should be assumed by the whole nation at once. If a black man counts at all now, he counts as 5/5 of a man, not as 3/5. 4 millions, therefore, and not 3/5 of 4 millions, are to be reckoned in here now. And in 11 states, most of these 4 millions were presumed to be unfit for political existence. Since the framers of the Constitution did not foresee such contingency and expected that emancipation would come gradually and be accompanied by education and enfranchisement, they provided for no situation whereby 11 states might claim 28 or 29 representatives besides their just proportion. 28 votes to be cast here and in the Electoral College for those held not fit to sit as jurors, not fit to testify in the court, not fit to be plaintiff in a suit, not fit to approach the ballot box. 28 votes to be more or less controlled by those who once betrayed the government, and for those so destitute we are assured of intelligent instinct as not to be fit for free agency. Shall this be? Shall 4 million beings count 4 million? In managing the affairs of the nation, who are pronounced by their fellow beings unfit to participate in administering government in the states where they live, who are pronounced unworthy of the least and most paltry part in the political affairs? Shall 127,000 white people in New York cast but one vote in this House and have but one voice here, while the same number of white people in Mississippi have 3 votes and 3 voices? Shall the death of slavery add 2/5 to the entire power which slavery had when slavery was living? Shall one white man have as much share in the government as 3 other white men, merely because he lives where blacks outnumber whites 2 to 1? Shall this inequality exist, and exist only in favor of those who did the foulest and guiltiest act which crimsons the annals of recorded time? No, sir. Not if I can help it. This proposition, he continued, rests upon a principle already embedded in the Constitution and as old as free government itself, a principle that representation does not belong to those who have no political existence, but to those who have. The object of the amendment is to enforce this truth. Every state will be left free to extend or withhold the elective franchise on such terms as it pleases, and this without losing anything in representation, if the terms are impartial as to all. If, however, there is found a race so vile or worthless that to belong to it is alone cause of exclusion from political action, the race is not to be counted here in the Congress. Thus spoke New York, in cold contrast, to Thaddeus Stevens, but with quite as merciless logic. This argument made it clear that the basis of representation must be changed in some way, unless the South was coming back with increased political power. What change should be made? The West wanted Stevens's original proposition, which had early been introduced in Congress by Stevens himself, and also separately by 2 Ohio representatives, and which based representation on voters. But this proposition would have increased the power of the Middle and Western states at the expense of New England, and New England had had her warning from Voorhees. While, then, a majority of Republicans undoubtedly favored this, the proposition could not pass Congress without the support of New England, and the West yielded. Eliot of Massachusetts submitted an amendment, which was practically the 15th Amendment, but it was agreed that this could not pass Congress. And so, finally, the report was sent back to the Committee of 15. Meantime, on January 22nd, the Bingham Amendment on Civil Rights was considered in the Committee of 15 and referred to a subcommittee after Boatwell had tried to make its wording milder by saying that Congress shall have power to abolish any distinction in the exercise of the elective franchise. On January 27th, This section was reported from the subcommittee with modifications and appeared now in the following words. Congress shall have power to make all laws, which shall be necessary and proper, to secure to all persons in every state full protection in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property, and to all citizens of the United States the same immunities, and also equal political rights and privileges. It was postponed. Bingham explained in 1871 that after postponement, he had introduced this section of the amendment in the Committee of 15 in the words in which it now stands in the Constitution. He had changed the form in the hope that the amendment might be so framed that, in all the hereafter, it might be accepted by the historian of the American Constitution like Magna Carta as the keystone of American legislation. The decision of Marshall versus the City Council of Baltimore, a celebrated case, had induced him to take counsel with Marshall. Thus, curiously enough, constitutional restraints, designated to protect persons, were changed into a form which eventually made the federal government the protector of property against state enactments. The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to secure to the citizens of every state all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. This substitute, which Bingham reported to the committee February 3rd, was adopted in the Committee of 15, and on February 10th, by a vote of 9-5, it was referred to Congress. It came up before the House of Representatives February 13th as a proposed constitutional amendment and was debated at length February 27th through 28th, when the House refused to table it but postponed it until April. When the Committee of 15 received the amendment on apportionment back from the House, it made the minor change of taking out the reference to direct taxes, which was irrelevant and of little importance. So that, again, January 31st, the proposition came back to the House of Representatives. Stevens was unequivocal. "I do not want them, the Southern states, to have representation. I say it plainly. I do not want them to have the right of suffrage before this Congress has done the great work of regenerating the Constitution and laws of this country according to the principles of the Declaration of Independence." Again, Schneck of Ohio tried to base representation on voters, but this was defeated. Stevens said that he favored it, but that it could not pass Congress. The House passed this form of the 14th Amendment January 3, 1866, and sent it to the Senate. In the meantime, the whole aspect of the political situation changed. The Freedmen's Bureau Bill had passed Congress, and to the astonishment of the country, had been vetoed. The Civil Rights Bill had passed the Senate, and Johnson had made his speech of February 22nd, definitely aligning himself now with the South and their Northern Democratic allies, and against his own party. Black codes had been passed in Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, Florida, Virginia, and Louisiana. On the other hand, Northern business was afraid. Viewed as a practical matter, asked the nation, what would be the effect upon government securities of the immediate admission to Congress of 58 Southern representatives and 22 senators, nearly all of whom could be counted on as determined repudiationists? It would hardly be a safe thing for the national credit to have such a body of men in Congress, reinforced as they would probably be by a considerable number of Northern men ready to go for at least qualified repudiation. Seward himself, it is said, was greatly disappointed and embarrassed by the black codes of the South. He found that the South was getting stronger in Johnson's confidence. Nemesis again dogged Seward's steps, as when before he was defeated for the presidential nomination by the anti-slavery men to whom he had given a slogan. It was then that Toombs had sneered, "Actian had been devoured by his dogs." The dogs were at it again. Blaine says that when Congress reassembled after the holidays, there was a great change in its attitude. Many feared that the president and the Democrats together would win. The leading commercial men, who had become weary of war, contemplated with positive dread the reopening of a controversy which might prove as disturbing to the business of the country as the struggle of arms had been, and without the quickening impulses to trade which active war always imparts. The bankers of the great cities, whose capital and whose deposits all rested upon the credit of the country and were invested in its paper, believed that the speedy settlement of all dissension and the harmonious cooperation of all departments of the government were needed to maintain the financial honor of the nation and to reinstate confidence among the people. Against obstacles so menacing, against resistance so ominous, against an array of power so imposing, it seemed to be an act of boundless temerity to challenge the president to a contest, to array public opinion against him, to denounce him, to deride him, to defy him. The Committee of 15 paused to get its bearings. In the first place, what was the attitude of the country toward Negro suffrage? In 1865, Wisconsin had rejected a proposal to let Negroes vote. Minnesota, the same year, had defeated a constitutional amendment giving Negroes the suffrage. Connecticut also, in 1865, gave a majority of 6,272 against Negro suffrage. Later, in 1867, Ohio defeated Negro suffrage by 50,629. In Michigan, 1868, a new constitution omitting the word white was defeated by a majority of 38,849. In the Nebraska Constitution of 1866, only whites were allowed the suffrage. In New York and some other states, there was special legislation on the voting of Negroes, which was not changed. Evidently, the country was not ready for Negro suffrage. Moreover, the pinch of economic difficulties following the war was beginning to be felt. The price of gold, which was at 170 in 1864, rose to 284 in 1865. The income tax had been increased in 1865. The United States was paying out vast sums of interest on its annual debt. Cotton was high, selling at 43 cents a pound in 1865. It dropped to 30 cents only in 1866, with a crop of 1,900,000 bales, as compared with that marvelous crop that precipitated the Civil War, 5,740,000 bales in 1861. The price of agricultural products had increased, but not nearly as much as the prices of manufactured goods, and the farmers were feeling the difference. Gambling and speculation were widespread. The United States Treasury was trying to reduce the circulation of the depreciated greenbacks, and under the Act of 1866, retired some $75 million. But early in 1868, the contraction of the currency was prohibited, and the West began to cry for inflation. A Western editor wrote Senator Trumbull of Illinois, "You all in Washington must remember that the excitement of the great contest is dying out, and that commercial and industrial enterprises and pursuits are engaging a large part of public attention. The times are hard. Money is close. Taxes are heavy. All forms of industry here in the West are heavily burdened. And in the struggle to pay debts and live, people are more mindful of themselves than of any of the fine philanthropic schemes that look to making Sambo a voter, juror, and office holder." Johnson knew nothing of finance and left the Treasury entirely to McCulloch, who was struggling, October 31, 1865, with a national debt that stood at $2.8 billion. There was still doubt of the legal tender constitutionality of the greenbacks. Taxation was enormous and applied to almost every available subject. There faced the country a tremendous problem of reorganizing the debt, reestablishing the currency, and reducing the revenue. Stevens had rushed the Committee of 15 as fast as or faster than his majority wished. The first draft of the 14th Amendment reached the Senate and was attacked by Charles Sumner. There was no greater proof of his courage, and his learning and keenness of mind were unquestioned. From the day of his great speech on Kansas to his unswerving advocacy of civil rights for Negroes and their political enfranchisement, he towered above his contemporaries. He was unwilling to compromise, like Stevens, and for that reason was not made head of the great Committee of 15. But there was no question about his integrity and his idealism. Sumner had no sympathy with an amendment which made the disfranchisement of Negroes possible and regarded it as another compromise with human rights and a discrimination on account of race and color which hitherto had been kept out of the Constitution. Thus, the first proposition which Northern industry made met the direct opposition of abolition democracy. Charles Sumner, in a tremendous speech, February 6, 1865, laid down the thesis that under no circumstances should it be possible to disfranchise a man simply on account of race or color, that here for the first time we had a chance to realize the democracy which the fathers of the Republic foresaw, and he spoke prophetic words on future disfranchisement. I am not insensible to the responsibility which I assume in setting myself against a proposition already adopted in the other House, and having the recommendation of a committee to which the country looks with such just expectations, and to which, let me say, I look with so much trust. But after careful reflection, I do not feel that I can do otherwise. There are among us 4 millions of citizens now robbed of all share in the government of their country, while at the same time they are taxed, according to their means, directly and indirectly, for the support of the government. Nobody can question this statement. And this bare-faced tyranny of taxation without representation, it is now proposed to recognize as not inconsistent with fundamental right and the guarantee of a republican government. Instead of blasting it, you go forward to embrace it as an element of political power. If by this you expect to induce the recent slave master to confer the right of suffrage without distinction of color, you will find the proposition a delusion and a snare. He will do no such things. Even the bribe you offer will not tempt him. If, on the other hand, you expect to accomplish a reduction of his political power, it is more than doubtful if you will succeed, while the means you employ are unworthy of our country. There are tricks and evasions possible, and the cunning slave master will drive his coach and six through your amendment stuffed with all his representatives. Should he cheat you in this matter, it will only be a proper return for the endeavor on your part to circumvent him at the expense of fellow citizens to whom you are bound by every obligation of public faith. Seldom has a great political prophecy been so strikingly fulfilled. Stevens in the House had, by his diplomacy, ranged back of his policy the industrial leaders of the North who feared that a return of the South would mean attack upon the tariff, the national banks, the debt, and the whole new post-war economic structure. Sumner in the Senate, on the other hand, took little account of the political game. He set his strategy on the high ground of democracy, and democracy for all men. And it was his opposition that killed the first draft of the 14th Amendment, which permitted the disfranchisement of Negroes on penalty of reduced representation. Stevens, with infinite pains, had gotten this much through the Committee of 15 and the House of Representatives. Sumner spoke his convictions despite the desertion of friends and party. Senator Williams of Oregon expressed admiration, but could not follow him. The echoes of his lofty and majestic periods will linger and repeat themselves among the corridors of history. There was wide discussion throughout the country. Garrison was converted, and to him Sumner's speech seemed unanswerable. To Whittier, it was irresistible. Phillips's voice was filled with enthusiasm, while Henry Ward Beecher said that the speech rose far above the occasion, covering a ground which will abide after all contemporary questions of special legislation have passed away. The proposed amendment went down to defeat on March 9th, receiving only 25 votes against 22, instead of the necessary two-thirds majority. Sumner's wide influence, while it did not command the full sympathy of Republicans or Democrats, nevertheless was enough to block compromise between Northern industry and the abolition democracy. Fessenden was bitter, and Stevens furious. No man demanded more for Negroes than Stevens, or was more thoroughly an advocate of complete democracy. But, as he said, the control of republics depends on the number, not the quality, of the voters. This is not a government of saints. It has a large sprinkling of sinners. As the head of the Committee of 15, he was trying to get a proposition for which a two-thirds majority of Congress would vote, and start the country as far on the road towards democracy and abolition of caste as was possible under the circumstances. He complained that his proposition had been slaughtered by a puerile and pedantic criticism. Andrew Johnson was deeply incensed by Sumner's speech and sneered at it next day. "I am free to say to you that I do not like to be arraigned by someone who can get up handsomely rounded periods and deal in rhetoric, and talk about abstract ideas of liberty, who never periled life, liberty, or property. This kind of theoretical, hollow, unpractical friendship amounts to but very little." He was receiving a group of Negroes who were trying to direct appeal, either to get his sympathy or to probe his animus against the race. The Freedmen's Bureau bill had passed, but Johnson had not yet indicated what action he would take. The Civil Rights Bill and the first draft of the 14th Amendment were before the Senate. Perhaps the delegation hoped to influence him. Douglas had seen Johnson on Inauguration Day in 1865, when President Lincoln had pointed Douglas out to him. The first expression which came to his face, and which I think was the true index of his heart, was one of bitter contempt and aversion. Seeing that I observed him, he tried to assume a more friendly appearance, but it was too late. In the interview with President Johnson, February 7, 1866, there were present George T. Downing of Rhode Island, William E. Matthews of New York, John Jones of Philadelphia, John F. Cook of Washington, Joseph E. Otis, A. W. Ross, William Whipper, John M. Brown, Alexander Dunlap, Frederick Douglass, and his son, Lewis. What was said on the occasion brought the whole question virtually before the American people. Until that interview, the country was not fully aware of the intentions and policy of President Johnson on the subject of Reconstruction, especially in respect to the newly emancipated class of the South. After having heard the brief addresses made by him to Mr. Downing and myself, he occupied at least 3/4 of an hour in what seemed a set speech, and refused to listen to any reply on our part, although solicited to grant a few moments for that purpose. The President shook hands with the colored men, and then George T. Downing, a leading Negro from Newport, Rhode Island, opened the discussion. He said to the President, "We desire for you to know that we come feeling that we are friends, meeting a friend." He said that they represented colored people from the state of Illinois, Wisconsin, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, the New England states, and the District of Columbia. They were not satisfied with an amendment prohibiting slavery, but wanted it enforced by appropriate legislation. "We are Americans, native-born Americans. We are citizens. We see no recognition of color or race in the organic law of the land. It has been shown in the present war that the government may justly reach its strong arm into the states and demand from those who owe it allegiance their assistance and support. May it not reach out a like arm to secure and protect its subjects upon whom it has a claim?" Then Frederick Douglass came forward and said, "Your noble and humane predecessor placed in our hands the sword to assist in saving the nation. And we do hope that you, his able successor, will favorably regard the placing in our hands the ballot with which to save ourselves." The President was evidently embarrassed and floundered. He was not going to make a speech. He had jeopardized life, liberty, and property, not only for the colored people, but for the great mass of people. He was a friend of the colored man, but "I do not want to adopt a policy that I believe will end in a contest between races, which, if persisted in, will result in the extermination of one or the other." He remembered his speech to Nashville Negroes before the election and repeated his willingness to be a Moses to lead him from bondage to freedom, but not into a war of races. He said that one can talk about the ballot box and justice and Declaration of Independence, but suppose by some magic touch you can say to everyone, "You shall vote tomorrow." How much would that ameliorate their condition at this time? Then the president approached Douglas and said, Now, let us get closer up to this subject. He said he opposed slavery because it was a monopoly and gave profit and power to an aristocracy. By getting clear of the monopoly, they had abolished slavery. Douglas started to interrupt, but the president was not through. He went on to show the position of the poor white in relation to the slave owners, and how the slaves despised the poor whites. Douglas denied this personally, but the president insisted that anyway. Most colored people did, and this made the poor white man opposed both to the slave and his master, and that, therefore, there was enmity between the colored man and the poor white. Already the colored man had gained his freedom during the war, and if he and the poor white came into competition at the ballot box, a war of races would result. Moreover, was it proper to put on a people without their consent, Negro suffrage? Do you deny that first great principle of the right of the people to govern themselves? Here Downing interrupted, Apply what you have said, Mr. President, to South Carolina, for instance, where a majority of the inhabitants are colored. The president twisted uncomfortably and said that the matter to which he referred comes up when a government is undergoing a fundamental change, and he preferred to instance Ohio rather than South Carolina. Was it right to force Ohio to make a change in the elective franchise against its will? He could not touch the question as to whether it was right to prevent a majority in South Carolina from ruling because, to his mind, no number of Negroes could outweigh the will of whites. He stumbled on without mentioning this suppressed minor premise and said, It is a fundamental tenet of my creed that the will of the people must be obeyed. Is there anything wrong or unfair in that? Douglas smiled, still thinking of South Carolina. A great deal that is wrong, Mr. President, with all respect. But the president insisted, It is the people of the states that must for themselves determine this thing. I do not want to be engaged in a work that will commence a war of races. Then he indicated that the interview was at an end. He was glad to have met them and thanked them for the compliment paid him. Douglas returned the thanks and said that they had not come to argue, but if the president would grant permission, we would endeavor to controvert some of the positions you have assumed. Mr. Downing, too, suggested persuasively that the president, by his kind explanation, must have contemplated some reply to the views which he has advanced. Douglas continued, I would like to say one or two words in reply. You enfranchise your enemies and disfranchise your friends. My own impression is that the very thing that Your Excellency would avoid in the southern states, can only be avoided by the very measure that we proposed. I would like to say a word or so in regard to that matter of the enfranchisement of the black, as a means of preventing the very thing which Your Excellency seems to apprehend. That is a conflict of races. The president naturally did not want to give publicity to views of Negroes antagonistic to his own, and said shortly that there were other places besides the South for the Negro to live. But, said Douglas, the masters have the making of the laws, and we cannot get away from the plantation. What prevents you? Asked Johnson. Douglas replied that his master then decides for him where he shall go, where he shall work, how much he shall work. He is absolutely in the hands of those men. The president replied, If the master now controls him or his actions, would he not control him in his vote? Douglas answered, Let the Negro once understand that he has an organic right to vote. And he will raise up a party in the southern states among the poor who will rally with him. There is this conflict that you speak of between the wealthy slave owner and the poor man. The president replied eagerly, You touch right upon the point there. There is this conflict, and hence I suggest immigration. The president then bowed his dark visitors out. saying they were all desirous of accomplishing the same ends, but proposed to do so by following different roads. Douglas, turning to leave, said, "The president sends us to the people, and we go to the people."